Deployment. New London, Timeline 3, May 2020. Miriam was deeply asleep, dreaming of an earlier life in another world's Boston when the red telephone rang. Once upon a time, she'd been a go-getting business journalist, working for a high-profile magazine that covered the boss-wash tech community. Her particular beat was the Cambridge-Boston biotech startup sector, but she'd covered other businesses too, until her investigation into the connection between a chain of second-hand car dealerships and a medical clinic had cost her her job and nearly her life. That kind of journalism didn't exist anymore in the United States. Caught in the crossfire between the Internet's corrosive impact on advertising and the burgeoning security state's disapproval of unauthorized snoopers and unembedded media, it had died out a decade ago. And in any case, her path had taken her unimaginably far from there. But she still dreamed of it from time to time, oppressed by a vaguely claustrophobic sense of nostalgia for her youth in a land of opportunity, when she'd been driving toward goals she'd long since outgrown. These days, her objectives were so huge, shimmering in the distant heat haze of the future like a mosaic vision of the promised land, she no longer expected to live to see them. It was 3 in the morning, and she was dreaming that she was on a conference call in the insider's offices, waiting on the line to speak to a source in a monoclonal antibody startup while an inexplicable earthquake rumbled. The telephone began to ring louder and louder. It wasn't the single long ring of an American phone, but a sequence of 3 short trills, then a pause, then 3 more. A Commonwealth telephone, summoning her to... She rolled over, and barely awake, reached for the handset on the nightstand. "Burgesson's, Miriam here." Beside her, Erasmus thrashed and snorted loudly, stopped snoring, and sat up.
"Commissioner, this is Commonwealth Crisis Command. I have General Ben on the line for you. Is Commissioner, the other Commissioner Burgesson, with you? This is an all-ears cabinet flash."
The bedside light flickered on. Miriam rolled on her back and pushed herself up against the headboard. Her husband looked at her. "Flash message for both of us," she said. Seconds passed as Erasmus untangled the telephone cord on his side of the bed and other commissioners joined the party line. Miriam waited, heart pounding. The cobwebs of sleep were fading, replaced by bone-deep fatigue and apprehension. "Is it the French?" she wondered.
"Citizens," a new voice came on the line. "This is Colonel General Ben, Watch Commander at CCC. I'm calling this cabinet flash because Air Defense Command has just reported the shootdown of a high-altitude radar occult aircraft 60 nautical miles off the New England coast. A capital weapon was used to complete the interception. Air Defense has had a system-wide alert in force just in case the intruder was French, but observation and backtracking suggests the intruder materialized out of nowhere. It was traveling out to sea when ADC lit it up and was well within the capital defense zone. In accordance with standing orders, we are declaring War Condition 2. The Continental Bombardment Force is scrambling its petard carriers to their dispersal stations. The Continuity Authority has been activated, and I am now notifying commissioners and senators of the crisis. Thank you for your attention."
The line crackled for a couple of seconds. Then a new voice spoke.
"Commissioners Burgesson and Burgesson, the first man is on his way to his designated location. He has asked for you to join him for a meeting at 9.
Miriam made eye contact with Erasmus. He grimaced and mouthed a quiet obscenity.
"We'll be ready to go in 15 minutes, she told the caller.
"Excellent, ma'am. A Rotodyne is on its way to collect you. It will touch down on the near end of Soldiers Field shortly."
Erasmus was already pulling on yesterday's trousers,
as Miriam put the phone down and shoved the bedding aside to stand up. He coughed horribly for a few seconds, then straightened up.
This can't be good.
No. Feeling shaky, Miriam opened her wardrobe and pulled out her emergency go bag. There was an appropriate outfit folded neatly in a paper bag atop it, a lady's trouser suit, not unlike a shalwar kameez. She dressed rapidly, then rang the service bell.
Erasmus and I have been called away suddenly, she spoke into the intercom. We'll need help with our luggage.
I'll send Jack up to carry it, ma'am.
It was Jenny, the housekeeper. She sounded sleepy and confused.
How long shall you be gone?
No idea, Miriam said tersely. Her knees ached and her hair was a rat's nest. Even so, Erasmus looked worse, his shirt rumpled and his neckcloth unfastened.
We need to be out at the double, on our way in 10 minutes.
Soldiers Field Public Park opened off the far end of the crescent their house faced. It was flat and level, and the size of several football fields, surrounded by a border of neatly manicured trees. The huge rotodyne descended onto the grass with a screeching roar from the ramjets on the ends of its rotor blades, landing lights glaring. The rotors kept spinning while it squatted on the field, doubtless waking the dead across a radius of miles. The rotodyne was a triumph of brute force engineering over subtlety. A heliplane, halfway between a big transport helicopter and a turboprop troop carrier, the product of a road not taken in the U.S. due to noise and fuel thirst, but effective nonetheless. Lights were coming on in homes all around as Miriam and Erasmus duck-walked toward it, guided by a pair of airmen. Doubtless radios and televisions were coming on, too. The news that the Air Defense Command had just shot down an unidentified intruder nearly 70 miles out past Cape Cod using a corpuscular weapon couldn't be kept quiet. The distant flare of the 2-megaton warshot would have been visible all the way from Boston to Baltimore. It was too loud to talk inside the aircraft as it spun up to takeoff power, but once they transitioned to level flight and the tip jets throttled back, things were no worse than on any other military turboprop. Miriam managed to make herself heard.
How long are we going to be airborne?
Only 40 minutes, ma'am. We're making nearly 200 knots. We'll have you inside the designated location within the hour.
Miriam frowned and glanced at Erasmus. He nodded, his face ashen. The new American Commonwealth didn't yet have anything like the USA's airborne command posts. The metallurgy for efficient high-bypass turbofans, engines that could keep a drone or a jumbo jet airborne for days on end, was tantalizingly close. In the meantime, the Commonwealth leadership had a radically different protocol for maintaining command during a nuclear war.
I'm going to dose up, she told her husband. They might need me to jump.
Not on my watch, he said firmly. Not unless the petards are falling. We need you lucid, not moaning from a killer migraine.
Thanks. She squeezed his hand. Still dosing up, mind.
The small bottle held 2 gelatin capsules, a devil's brew of antihypertensives and painkillers. They were the Commonwealth's best self-administered solution to the effects of world walking. The rotodyne screeched on through the night, props and rotors thundering. 15 minutes into the flight, the radio operator came aft, saluted, and handed Erasmus a teleprinted message. He skimmed it, then passed it wordlessly to Miriam. Intruder detected. 0219 hours. Radar contact, latitude 41 degrees, 40 minutes, 16.92 seconds north, longitude 69 degrees, 24 minutes, 32.15 seconds west, altitude 64,400 feet,
bearing 066 degrees, 58 minutes, ground speed 590 miles per hour. Flight plan absent, break. Faux identity failed, break. Hail unanswered, break. Missile intercept plan issued at 0230 hours. Missile battery engaged target at 0234 hours. Intruder presumed destroyed by Zeus 4 missile at 0237 hours. Last contact at latitude 41 degrees, 43 minutes, 51.32 seconds north, longitude 68 degrees, 18 minutes, 9.44 seconds west, altitude 64,800 feet, bearing 066 degrees, 58 minutes, ground speed 582 miles per hour.
"They didn't mess around," Miriam muttered, heedless of her throat mic.
Zeus 4 was a long-range surface-to-air nuclear missile. It was unguided and unjammable, but able to reach out and swat an enemy aircraft with a 2-megaton warhead from over 100 miles away. Brute force weapons like the old Nike Hercules had gone out of fashion in the USA during the 1970s as sensitive electronics proliferated. A Zeus strike would burn out every unshielded microprocessor within 50 miles. Luckily, unshielded microprocessors were a rarity in the Commonwealth, and would remain so, thanks to MITI-dictated national shielding standards. Miriam was still shaken from learning a nuclear weapon had just been fired in anger for the first time in nearly 20 years, and at a stealthy intruder, capable of flying as high and fast as a U-2, that had appeared out of thin air.
"This wasn't the French," she said in a thin voice. "They don't have the tech, and they know better than to tug our tail like that. No, this is an escalation over last month's incidents."
The earlier American drones had popped up in controlled airspace far to the southwest, flying fat and happy at medium altitude. Air Defense Command had scrambled their shiniest missile-armed supersonic interceptors and used them for target practice. Afterward, DPR's analysts had identified the recovered wreckage as coming from MQ-1 Predators, obsolescent unmanned turboprops so embarrassingly outclassed that even the French could have shot them down. This new contact was a much more potent adversary.
"The sooner we get to the redoubt, the better."
Erasmus sounded no happier than she felt. Sick terror twisted her stomach until she feared she'd need to reach for the bag under her seat. She hadn't seen the bombs fall on the Grunmarkt, but her mother had. Iris had described them in morbid detail, and suffered from nightmare flashbacks for the rest of her life. A row of distant flashbulbs, their sullen heat refracted through cloud, popping in the distance. Then another row of hell sparks, detonating closer. Ripples in the blood-stained sky as the overlapping shockwaves tore apart the cloudscape. Panic as the burning rain crept closer, deceptively slowly, dripping from a storm front of bombers traveling just below the speed of sound. They'd sent scouts to the Grunmarkt shortly afterward, wearing dosimeters and protective clothing, and keeping a low profile in case the USA had monitors in place. When Miriam had seen the photographs, she'd thrown up, then slept badly for a week.
"It's too soon. We're not ready. The Juggernaut program is nowhere near ready."
He looked at her tiredly.
"We can't use that thing."
"No, but if we demonstrated we had a superweapon of that caliber, they'd have to back down. Deterrence works, love. Game theory doesn't lie. It worked for half a century back in the old world. It's working for us on the French. When Juggernaut is complete and we've made overt contact, nobody will be crazy enough to attack us." His chest rose and fell, wheezing, After a few seconds, he reached into his coat pocket and removed a small metal aerosol inhaler. After he used it, the panting slowly subsided. A minute later, he could speak again.
"Your faith in psychology is wonderfully strong, dear."
He gave her a crooked little smile, clearly more worried than he was prepared to admit.
"Right now, we're boxing blindfolded with hand grenades taped to our gloves. We need intelligence. We need to know who and what we're up against."
"I've got people working on it," Miriam reassured him, as the engine note of the turboprops shifted, heralding the start of their descent.
"I just hope they deliver before it's too late."
Baltimore, Timeline 2, July 2020.
"What do you want from me?"
Rita tried to keep a whine of frustration from creeping into her voice.
"I don't understand where this is going."
Smith looked at her disapprovingly from across the expanse of his desk.
"Rita, calm down. It's not about you."
The tension in his shoulders said something like, "God, give me strength."
"We have a problem, a very special kind of problem. One you might be able to help us with if you can stop acting like a drama queen for 5 minutes.
"I'm not..."
Rita managed to hold the words back with an effort. Familiarity was making it too easy to open up to Colonel Smith and his team of handlers. She needed to focus harder if she was to keep a grip on herself. Even surrounded by increasingly familiar faces, she felt lonely and defensive.
"I'm listening."
"You're listening what?"
"I'm listening, sir."
Smith nodded stiffly.
"That's better."
"I don't remember joining the services, sir. Sorry. I do know a sandbox when I'm in one. I'm not a mushroom. I don't thrive in the dark on a diet of bullshit."
"No, I don't suppose you do."
Smith's lips were thin.
"None of us do. And you're perfectly right. You didn't swear the oath. And you're right, we're keeping you in a box. But the less you know about the rest of the Office of Special Programs and DHS, the less you can give away."
"Give away? This is the run-up to a covert deployment, isn't it? You want me to spy for you?"
"Yes, but..."
Smith leaned back and stared at the wall behind and above her head.
"I'm having some second thoughts."
"Why, sir?"
Smith glanced down to meet her gaze. His eyes were pale blue. She found his stare disturbingly intense.
"It's premature. Rita, in all honesty, you're nowhere near ready for this. The usual recruitment and training structure for a clandestine operative is for us to sound them out in college, security clear them before hiring, then deploy them on an analysis desk for years of intensive immersion, often with added language training, in the target culture. We evaluate, assess their progress, identify their shortcomings, and assign them more training until they're perfectly acculturated for the destination. Then we generate their cover identity and background material and inject them. Modern biometrics and DNA databases mean that a clandestine asset gets just one home run in an entire career. If they're really lucky, if there are two different target nations with a shared culture that don't get on well enough to share their frontier databases, they might get a second outing under a new identity, but one is the rule. After their covert identity is retired, they come home and teach the next generation of agents, or retire to the analysis desk. But they can't operate in the field again. Two different names on passports with the same genetic fingerprint and facial bone structure will start alarm bells ringing. So we don't deploy agents lightly. We only send the best of the best, and we train them for years first to make sure we get the most bang for our bucks."
"But you..."
Rita paused for a moment, assessing her next words carefully.
"You grabbed me at zero notice.
and I've only been training for a few months. Did something go wrong? Or were you watching me before?
Yes to both.
Smith leaned forward.
Jaunt Blue is very new. You're the first recipient. It only works on non-world-walking descendants of the clan. And we don't have many of them. If we'd known we'd have it 5 years ago, you'd probably have been contacted in college, steered toward the right degree. And we'd still be sitting here right now, but you'd be fully trained and cognizant of the reasons for what we're doing. As it is, though, you're barely one step above a raw recruit. To make matters worse, we're completely in the dark about the Target Society, so we desperately need clandestine resources. You are all we've got, and some people I report to who you do not need to know about do not believe we can rely on you. I'd like to prove them wrong, but not at the cost of a blown operation and a dead agent. That would be you.
It hit her like a bucket of cold water in the face. There's no one else yet? He shook his head, lips pursed. How long until...
3 years, minimum.
But I'm... She stopped. Why so long?
We have a very limited pool of Jaunt Blue candidates, Rita. You're the oldest.
I'm the oldest?
He spoke slowly at first. Your birth mother and her mother were clan runaways. There may be other deserters, but despite looking hard, we haven't found them yet. As for the rest, there's a pool of inactive Q-machine carriers. The clan were using a fertility clinic in Massachusetts to breed children carrying the trait by the thousand. We found a copy of the breeding program records, but the oldest of the cohort are just turning 21 now.
So that's why you sank all that money into Jaunt Blue?
Smith nodded. Spending $500 million on one agent wouldn't make much sense, would it? But if as many as 5% of the clan's breeding program clear their background checks and join up, we'll have the nucleus of a decent clandestine paratemporal intelligence service in 5 to 10 years' time.
But I'm a prototype?
Yes.
And the clan tried to snatch me off the street because of my birth mother?
Yes.
Smith paused for a fraction of a second too long.
Gotcha, Rita thought sourly. It's the first hint we've had in 17 years that she may have survived.
Survived what? His gaze focused beyond her again, on some unseen vista of historic failure.
Let's just say mistakes were made in the lead-up to 716.
Rita froze, riveted. Does that mean what I think it does?
Smith refocused on her. The CIA were in contact with Osama bin Laden before 2001, you know. But that doesn't mean they were responsible for 9/11. Nor were the clan an accidental creation of ours. They didn't give us any concrete demands or try to negotiate before they bombed the White House. I want you to be very clear on that. We stumbled on them and tried to shut them down, and they attacked us with stolen demolition nukes. Escalated straight to mass murder. They left President Rumsfeld no option other than to respond in kind.
Rita shied away from thinking about it too hard. There'd been rolling video footage for weeks all over the TV and internet when she was 8. First, the Washington Monument, toppling on a shockwave, a fiery cloud rising where the White House had been. Then a month later, the horrors of New Delhi and Islamabad. When the news of world walking broke, the Cold War between India and Pakistan had abruptly turned nuclear. World War 2.5, they'd called it afterwards. Finally, unrolling beneath a camera mounted in the tail of a high-altitude U.S. Air Force bomber, the TV news brought home the U.S. government's revenge on the World Walker's home timeline. A field of ghastly, flaming mushroom clouds had risen in parallel lines, spanning the horizon and bisecting the pale neck of history like a blow from a headsman's axe.
You've seen Camp Singularity and the dome and the gate.
Colonel Smith nudged her mercilessly toward the precipice.
What happened there was even worse than 716. Rita, the Forerunners may be dead or they may still be out there. We don't know. They may be connected with the Clan Worldwalkers. Again, we don't know. The Jaunt Blue Q machines didn't evolve naturally, that's for sure. What we do know, via mitochondrial DNA studies of captured clan members, is that they all share a common ancestor who lived less than 2.5 centuries ago. From what we know of the clan's world, they could no more build Q machines than Benjamin Franklin could build an H-bomb. So all the evidence points to a high-technology paratime civilization that was active in the recent historic past. We think the clan may actually be descended from a deserter or runaway from that civilization, like your birth grandmother. But as I said, we just don't know for sure.
Without realizing she was doing it, Rita had raised her left fist to her mouth. Now she found herself gnawing on her knuckles. So you found them. That's what this is all about.
We don't know, Smith said gently. We want you to find out.
If they're the clan's ancestors, or the forerunners, or their enemies?
They might be any of the above, or something else entirely. We don't know. All we know is that we opened up a new timeline recently. This one was accessible via those parts of Timeline 1, the clan's former home, that don't still glow in the dark, which suggests a clan connection. We lost 3 reconnaissance drones in rapid succession when we started trying to map it, but the 4th drone survived and brought back some highly suggestive photographs.
Another dome?
Nothing so high-tech. It looks like a big railway freight switchyard, near the site of downtown Allentown on our timeline, on the outskirts of Philly. There are buildings and probably a city as well, but it's not ours.
Railway freight? Rita frowned, puzzling over the drip of data. But so far all the timelines we've found have been uninhabited or Stone Age, haven't they? Apart from Camp Singularity.
Yes. Smith gave her an encouraging smile. Pretend you're a fully trained analyst. What does that tell you?
The Forerunners built the gate. They had unimaginable powers. Still, it's hard to see them building railroads, isn't it?
Carry on.
But a freight yard?
The dust of history classes stirred in her memory.
That means they're industrialized. They've got steam locomotives, at a minimum, and enough factories and stuff to need heavy rail freight? And we still use rail freight for shipping goods around. Hang on, we lost 3 drones?
Smith nodded again, seeing the horror dawning in her widening eyes.
Carry on.
You found an industrial civilization that can shoot down high-altitude reconnaissance drones? With stealth technology? Oh,
She bit her knuckles again to stifle the curse.
Stealth isn't a magic invisibility cloak. It's more like camouflage. It works best from certain angles. And it doesn't work at all if your opponents are sneaky enough. It's no good being invisible to radar if you fly through a storm by mistake. The bad guys can look for the hole in the rain that's moving at 600 miles per hour. We've spent so long snooping on jihadis in the tribal territories on the Afghan border, or rock bangers with flint hand axes in undeveloped timelines, that we've forgotten how to deal with a real threat. So now we've got this headache timeline and we're having to relearn old skills fast. Now we might be looking at a Victorian level of technology given those railways, but it's highly unlikely that we lost 3 UAVs by accident. It's much more likely that we're looking at a minimum, a timeline with 1950s technology. That's radar and surface-to-air missiles. Nuclear weapons are a distinct possibility. Which is why your superiors and mine are quietly screaming for intelligence that simply doesn't exist. They're looking in a mirror that's showing them their own response to first contact with another paratime civilization, and they don't much like what they see. Especially as there's a risk that this timeline is more developed than we are, or that they're being watched by the Forerunners. We don't know.
Oh, Jesus. Rita stared at Smith, her mind whirling. So, that's what you want me for, isn't it? You think a mid-20s female with acting skills can sneak in and quietly look around and report back on everything?
He didn't need to nod this time. She continued. It's not going to be quick.
We don't know what language they speak, do we? Or what they wear? Or what they look like? Whether I'll stand out because of my appearance?
Smith nodded again. If you take it on, it's not going to be easy. In fact, it's potentially extremely hazardous. If we had more time, I'd send you on courses in social anthropology and ethnography first. Also for training with field anthropologists, not to mention more work on personal self-defense and espionage tradecraft, because you're going to be unarmed, except for your jaunt blue ability. On the other hand, if you agree to do this for us, we'll give you all the support we can provide. Clothing, money, covert recording instruments.
Money?
Well, assuming they use money, and you can get us some samples. We have friends in the Treasury Department who spend all their time examining forgeries. This will be a nice change for them, don't you think? And you've got another huge advantage over a conventional clandestine agent. You can choose your insertion point. It could be virtually anywhere, as long as nobody's watching.
Wow. It was an enormous picture. Assuming it was true, it also shed a new light on his willingness to manipulate her. And despite having hard evidence that he'd lied to her in the past to railroad her into this position, she couldn't imagine why he might want to lie to her about this now. It's huge, isn't it?
Yes, Rita. It's an enormous responsibility. It's the sharp end of a mission that, done right, could save us from a nuclear war. Done wrong, you don't want to think about that.
She bit her lip. When do I start? And where?
Tomorrow morning, you're going to an installation outside Philly, as near as we can place it, to that railroad yard. The unit is setting up a forward support site right now, and once you're checked in, we'll begin drafting an operational checklist and insertion plan. If, that is, you're volunteering.
The unit. It had an ominous ring to it. Yet another sandbox, to keep Rita hemmed in and ignorant of what was really going on. I don't feel ready for this. There's no alternative, is there? Smith spoke haltingly.
I am not going to strong-arm you into saying yes. If there's one thing worse than having no agent, it's having an agent who is scared out of their wits and doesn't want to be there. So, you are allowed to say no if you really don't think you're up to it.
But if I say no, there's no one else who can do this job, is there? She asked, deliberately pushing him toward another lie. Go on, tell me the truth. Just this once.
She knew it was foolish, but she found his evasion inexpressibly depressing. I wish there were. I really wish there were. But we're out of time.
Rita nodded reluctantly. So she was working for an unscrupulous liar. Worse, one who didn't see anything wrong with lying because his motives were entirely pure. What should I do? She wondered. Then, what would Grandpa say?
Philadelphia, Timeline 2, August, 2020.
Rocks, Rita said disbelievingly.
Really? Yep. Rocks.
Patrick, her supervisor from Camp Graceland, and now it seemed her field officer, hefted a chunk of misshapen pink granite, a couple of inches long,
like this one.
What's so special about them? Rita shifted her weight. The cheap conference seat creaked unfairly beneath her.
I'm not that heavy, she complained silently.
Like everything else on this site, an office suite attached to a light industrial unit in Allentown on the outskirts of Philly, it was second-hand and had seen better days.
It's instrumented. The batteries are good for 7 days, during which it will continuously record meteorological conditions and high-definition video, optical and infrared, whenever anything moves around it. It can report over Bluetooth if you go within 100 feet of it while carrying an active transponder that's paired with it, but it doesn't broadcast its presence. This one... Patrick picked up another object, which resembled a battered length of 2x4. Has a 6-month life and inertial sensors. It works with a transponder disguised as a different rock. You drop the transponder in the switchyard and toss the mobile unit on top of a caboose or a shunting engine, and it builds a map of the track network as it gets pushed around, then calls in whenever it comes back to the same switchyard. You probably don't want to put it on a goods wagon, though. Not unless you want it to go on an extended tour of North America.
Uh-huh. Rita stared at Patrick's rock and scrap collection. So what's the plan?
The plan is to build out our knowledge of the target timeline, starting with somewhere relatively safe. We know there's a railroad yard, so we want you to go through there at night and scatter sensors around a couple of key areas without being seen. The first mission will be a double jaunt into the switchyard via a place you do not want to linger in. It'll be a quick in and out, 15 minutes max. We leave the sensors in place for a day, then you go back to collect them. That gives us a preliminary site survey, so we can pick a better insertion site for the next mission, when you will plant hidden cameras and mics on platforms and offices. We need to know a whole lot more. What language they speak, whether it's related to any that we know, what their writing looks like, what they wear, their ethnicity or physical appearance, before we can develop a covert program.
An entire program? It was a daunting prospect. But I'm just one woman. What can I...
You're the spearhead for Black Rain, Patrick interrupted.
His expression was serious.
That's the code word for this operation, to investigate this timeline. We need you to spy out the lay of the land. Your goal is to establish a toehold, learn the basics, and finally identify a safe location on the other side where we can drop non-worldwalkers. Then they can take over the heavy lifting. Once we've established a transfer gate, you won't be needed there again, but we'll probably want to do the same thing elsewhere. Maybe even overseas.
Rita stared at the rocks apprehensively. What if they discover the rocks?
They'll be disguised as track ballast. Over here, we lay 3,000 tons of the stuff per mile of track. Even if they figure out there's a bug in the ballast, searching a switchyard for passive transponders would be like looking for needles in a haystack the size of Iowa. You'll only be able to find them yourself because we'll give you a signaling device that can make them flash an infrared LED for your night vision goggles.
And if they have infrared floodlights and CCTV like an Amtrak depot?
Patrick shook his head.
Then you cut and run and we have a very big headache. Rita, our number one priority here is to get you back safely. Never doubt that, because you can tell us far more about what's going on than any dumb sensor.
Rita tried to make it work inside her head.
Okay, so say we've got a surveyed location. At the designated time I suit up, cross over to the switchyard, drop a bunch of rocks, plant a couple of bits of debris on suitable cabs if I see anything, then come back. Is that it?
Yes. It'll be a walk in the park. Just like the Apollo astronauts had.
Patrick seemed tired. To Rita's eyes, he looked like he'd been working overtime for too many nights.
You'll be wearing body armor and a night vision system, and you'll have a bunch of cameras strapped to your helmet, along with inertial sensors. It'll be like one of those haptotech motion capture systems you worked with, so we can put together a virtual map of the yard after you come back. But that's about it. We've arranged for a trainer from the Federal Railroad Administration to come in after lunch to give you a basic safety briefing on what hazards you can expect in a switchyard. There are no guarantees that they do things the same way we do, but we can make some approximate guesses based on the photographs. Their track and loading gauge, maximum track curvature and length of railroad cars, which tell us things like how fast and how heavy their trains are. Oh, and the switch layout and siding geometry tells us how they load and unload stuff. But I'd better leave that to the FRA guy. And then after his briefing, I'm sure you'll want to sack out.
Why? You're planning on sending me through tonight? She asked, half joking. They can't possibly be in that much of a hurry.
Yes, at 3:15 precisely.
Philadelphia, Timeline 2. Iron Gate, Timeline 3. August, 2020. At 3:10 in the morning, Rita shifted her weight uneasily from one knee to the other. They were standing around in the middle of a parking lot behind the windowless warehouse unit the unit had appropriated. Rita, Patrick, a cluster of technicians, a pair of armorers, the peripatetic DHS agents, Sonia Gomez and Jack Mercer. Rita had finally achieved a high enough security clearance to learn his surname, and a bunch of uniformed officers had established a secure perimeter around the entire block, thereby ensuring that every undesirable within a 50-mile radius knew something was going down. After the afternoon briefing on how not to lose life or limbs to a bump-shunted boxcar, Rita had crashed out until 10 o'clock. But now she was awake, pumped high on bad coffee and strapped into a Mall Ninja's parody version of a James Bond outfit. The ensemble consisted of boots, black BDUs, armor, and a mad scientist helmet that sprouted VR glasses, a life logger, and a pair of night vision scopes cantilevered off the front. She lacked only a scary-looking gun to fit the part perfectly, but although Patrick had asked if she wanted a pistol, she'd declined. First, I don't know if I could shoot anyone. And second, if I did, it would totally fuck the mission, wouldn't it?
Right answer, he'd told her. If you see any sign of trouble, you jaunt away immediately. If we luck out, anyone who sees you will think they were hallucinating. But you don't want to be seen. Got that?
Got it. She'd nodded queasily, her head unbalanced by the helmet-mounted protrusions. Meanwhile, the support team was laying out her planned ground track on the asphalt, using crime scene tape. Walk me through this again. Headset, capture map on. That had been a couple of hours ago. Since then, they'd run her through endless checklists, made her replay her choreographed series of steps in the head-up display of her glasses 3 times, following them in real time so that it became a habit to step within her own ghostly footsteps, and updated the folks upstairs, who were waiting with the colonel in a committee room somewhere in Maryland. And now, Rita's bladder was embarrassingly full. This is going to sound stupid, she said apologetically, but I really need to go to the bathroom.
You need to go? Can't it wait?
Gomez sounded disgusted, but Patrick cut her off.
Let her go.
He glanced at Rita.
Just don't take too long.
Rita scuttled through the open door of the warehouse unit like a black-clad cockroach, making a beeline for the ground-floor restroom. Her bladder was full. Coffee and nerves were a potent combination. Her stomach was also full of butterflies. I can do this, she told herself, self-consciously self-aware. It's just another role. Front of stage, your name in lights.
Today's late night billing. Secret agent woman Rita Douglas in Black Rain.
She made it back to the taped out departure zone with 2 minutes to spare.
Stand there, said Gomez.
System check. Rita looked at the transparent cutout in the forearm of her left sleeve. She squeezed a now familiar pattern, then switched on the ultraviolet light above her helmet visor. Phosphorescence glimmered against the darkness of her skin.
Test pattern works. GFP phosphenes work. Black light lamp works.
She looked straight forward through her night vision eyepieces.
Night vision works.
Her mouth was dry.
1 minute to go, called Patrick.
Rita looked around, then queued up her captured choreography in a window at the side of her glasses. She felt curiously trapped, hot even though it was a cool night. The moon had set.
30 seconds. 20. 10. 5.
She focused on her trigger engram and jaunted. Rita stumbled among trees in the darkness. A night rain was falling, pattering off leaves overhead. The air smelled overwhelmingly green. Damn. Obstacles, she realized. She'd been lucky to come out between them. Trying to jaunt into the same place as a solid object was impossible, but the shock it gave her was like brief contact with a live wire, or the jolting sensation of falling on the edge of sleep. In her ear, mingling with the leafy rustling and the dripping of rain on trees, she heard the clicking of a radiation counter. Timeline 1 was still hot from the nuking of the Grunmarkt. She took a deep breath of forest air, squeezed to summon the next trigger engram in the sequence. Dim green phosphorescent fireflies glowed on the back of her wrist, shimmering as they shifted into a tantalizingly not quite familiar knotwork design, and she jaunted again. This time she slipped, feet sliding on sharp-edged rough pebbles. The air on her face was warmer. She looked around. A tall wall rose beside her. It was right in the path of her programmed dance step through the switchyard. She blinked, focusing. It's a shipping container, she realized. A shipping container on a flatbed wagon. I need to capture this. It looked, ironically, just like any other shipping container she'd ever seen. 40 feet of corrugated steel with twist-lock connectors at each corner. It loomed above her like a wall with another container stacked atop it. The wagon bed rose above the bogies at either end. Shit, Rita muttered under her breath. The bed of the wagon left barely a 2-foot gap above the track, and the man from the FRA had taken considerable pains to impress on her the unwisdom of crawling around under a railroad wagon. She turned round. The next set of tracks gleamed empty in the starlight. Headset, new capture map, on. She was about to step across the tracks when there was a dull thudding sound behind her, and the container jerked. Rita dived for cover. Lying on her stomach, heart pounding, she forced herself to turn her head sideways. The train began to move, with a squeaking and squealing of steel wheels on rails and a clatter of chains. As it inched past, only feet away, she reached into her sling bag and found some of the false ballast. One she threw past her head, another she planted in the direction of her feet. Then she grabbed hold of the transponder rock, ready for the fake 2x4. A bogey inched slowly past, wheels grating harshly. Then another slid into view. She looked up. Lettering stood out in ghostly silhouette on the steel flank of the container. Iron Gate Imports, Incorporated. Breathing deeply, Rita tried to control her shakes. The terror that had sunk its icy claws into her began to subside. A flash of blue-white light, bright as lightning, flickered in the distance above the track. She looked up and saw a gantry spanning 6 or 7 tracks, with cables slung beneath it.
Electricity,
she thought dismally. I could be electrocuted as well as crushed. With a primal bump-thump, the stacked container wagon jolted across a track weld as it passed her. Another rolled past, then a third. Finally, the end of the sliding wall of metal came into view. A small shunting locomotive, unlike anything she recognized from back home, pushed the string of freight wagons forward. It was small only in comparison to its gargantuan payload. The bottom of the cab door had to be at least 6 feet above the rails. A pantograph buzzed atop its roof, occasionally sparking. I am so not messing with that, Rita decided. As it slid past, she saw an opportunity to resume her aborted sequence of dance moves, so she stood up and followed her ghostly footsteps across the switchyard. She crossed 6 tracks, distributing surveillance pebbles. At the next track, she landed a prize. Another of the shunting engines sat stationary and dark, pantograph lowered. She cautiously reached up and slid the 2x4 with the concealed mapper atop the walkway around the loco's transformers, then looked around. I'm out of targets, she told the life logger. I'm going to have a look round. Countdown timer for 5 minutes, please. Standing in the shadow of the shunter, she slowly scanned the visible horizon of the yard. Strings of container wagons lay parked in sidings. The train she'd seen before was rolling steadily now, clattering across points. A long, low maintenance shed blocked her view in one direction. Another parked train concealed the other horizon, but for a control tower looming above it. Lights burned in the distance, blue and green and red. Farther off, amber floodlights splashed a bright sodium glare across the tracks, almost washing out her sensitive night vision goggles. Rita felt a sudden vertiginous wash of perspective. Had she world-walked at all? Or merely teleported to another location in Pennsylvania? It was hard to tell. A momentary thought struck her, lodged quivering in her mind. That's odd, she thought. The tracks are too far apart, aren't they? She looked in both directions carefully, then stepped between the nearest rails. Kneeling, she stretched her right hand out to touch the inner edge of the track on that side. Lifelogger, bookmark this. Headset, new capture map. Pinned to right hand. She held her arm out stiff as she touched the rail, then swung round until it touched inside the other rail. Lifelogger, bookmark this. It should give us the track gauge near enough. Next time I'll bring a tape measure. She stood again, feeling momentarily dizzy, just as the timer she'd set beeped softly for attention. Okay, time to go home now. She retraced her steps and jaunted twice in succession, confident that her first mission had been a success. Baltimore, Timeline 2, August 2020. Federal Employee 00493031, Classified Voice Transcript. Dr. Scranton. So what did we learn from our first human foray into Black Rain? Colonel? Colonel Smith.
We got lucky.
Liaison, State Department.
Why? Was there an unanticipated risk?
Colonel Smith.
Yes. We nearly lost Rita. Stumbling around a railway switchyard at night after the moon's set is a risky business. She put a good face on it, but I replayed the motion capture log and she came this close to falling under a moving freight train.
Liaison, State Department.
Jesus!
Dr. Scranton. No oaths, please. We're on the record. Liaison, State Department.
Sorry, Colonel Smith. Thank you. Luckily for us, she made a good recovery. And after the train passed, she distributed the sensor nodes exactly as instructed.
Afterward, she went for a 10-minute stroll to get her bearings, then came back. She stayed within the remit of her instructions at all times. I'm entirely satisfied with the way she conducted herself.
Dr. Scranton. Okay. Findings?
Colonel Smith. This is where it gets disturbing. Firstly, they use intermodal freight containers just like ours. They're too like ours. For one thing, they're labeled in English.
Liaison, State Department.
That doesn't sound possible. You're sure?
Colonel Smith.
Yes, definitely. Rita didn't get a close look at much, but her helmet cams picked up stuff she missed. All the text in the frame uses the Latin alphabet and conforms to Anglophone spelling rules. There wasn't much of it, mind you, and it was night, but there was enough evidence.
Liaison, State Department.
Could it be another version of our R timeline? A close cousin?
Colonel Smith.
That's what we thought at first. But Rita's a smart kid. She thought there was something wrong with the tracks, so she knelt down and used her motion capture instrumentation to measure the gauge, the gap between the rails, exactly. We run on standard gauge, 4 feet, 8.5 inches. Rita measured their gauge at 5 feet, 1 inch, plus or minus an inch or so. Now that might be Pennsylvania broad gauge. The Pittsburgh and West Penn railways ran on a 5 foot, 2.5 gauge, but we've never used those for container freight lines. Those railroads went bust in 1952 and 1964, respectively. So even if this is a kissing cousin timeline, it almost certainly diverged more than 60 years ago.
Dr. Scranton.
Good work. What else do we know?
Colonel Smith.
They use overhead current and electric traction for freight shunters, so they electrified their heavy rail freight network, like in Europe, or the new Chinese and Indian systems. But there's more. Rita glimpsed what we presume to be signal lights, but they don't follow the usual color convention, red, yellow, and green. These used blue. Nobody we know uses blue light signals.
Liaison, State Department.
Sorry, gentlemen. This changes everything, doesn't it?
Colonel Smith.
I don't see why. If they haven't got world walkers, they can't touch us. And if they do have world walkers, then as soon as they learn about us, they'll infer our ability to generate a second strike retaliatory capability. A bomb wing of B-52s out of Thule should be enough to keep them from getting frisky.
Dr. Scranton.
That's above our pay grade, gentlemen. What else have we learned?
Colonel Smith.
A lot of fine detail about the layout of a rail freight switchyard near Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Nothing else, as yet. Unless you say otherwise, I'm sending her back over again tonight. Mission objective this time round will be to do an initial data retrieval from the sensor net she installed, then to plant optical imagers and audio pickups somewhere more useful. I want to target the station platform and offices. We want to confirm that they speak English, and if so, what sort of accent they have. We want to get a good look at their clothing, demographics, and security protocols. It's all essential legwork before we send Rita on an actual undercover mission. Basic know-your-enemy stuff.
Dr. Scranton.
Do you have any recommendations you'd like to add, Colonel? Anything for me to pass up the chain?
Colonel Smith.
Yes, I do. These people might be our long-lost cousins, but they've had at least 60 years of divergence, and they've got nukes. And they've shot down 3 of our drones. They're dangerously competent, if not just plain dangerous. Imagine how we'd respond if parties unknown began probing us with drones, then sent world-walking human assets to check us out. We'd shit a brick, assume the worst, and reach for the big stick.
Dr. Scranton,
So you're saying we should exercise extreme caution?
Colonel Smith. That's exactly it, ma'am. Because if we don't, someone's going to get burned. And it might be us.
End transcript. Near Phoenix, Timeline 2, May 2020. The federal government took justifiable pride in the comprehensive scope of its communication traffic monitoring activities. It was, without doubt, a best-of-breed program. Every phone call's endpoint was logged, every email was tracked, and quite possibly, the NSA's vast server farms were converting those phone calls into text and indexing them for future recovery. The Internet was totally surveilled, and the Internet of Things, everything with an Internet connection, from toaster ovens to televisions, was also surveilled. Every fat phone's or cell phone's location was monitored as its owner moved around, and it switched between cell towers for better reception. Every automobile and truck and bicycle notified the Federal Highway Administration of its location, the better to prevent interstate commerce crime. And every city block in every town with more than 10,000 souls boasted a high-definition webcam on every street corner, monitoring pedestrian and vehicle traffic. Kurt Douglas, for his part, found it a never-ending source of wry amusement. The diminishing marginal utility of information had been a vexatious nuisance to the Stasi, the East German secret police, back in his youth. The more you knew, the more chaff you had to process with your wheat. The more true positives you had for dissent, the more false positives you had to eliminate. False positives who were good citizens falsely accused would, even if cleared, be ruined, their hearts dead to the cause. Subtle secret policemen walked softly and exercised a feather-light touch until they were certain of their prey. Unfortunately, by its nature, the profession offered an attractive career to crude authoritarians. The soul of the American surveillance machine was just as drab and bureaucratic gray as the East German system he'd grown up under, and it recorded everything. For example, every parcel and letter and postcard passing through the USPS network was photographed digitally, sniffed for drugs and explosives, pinged for illicit memory chips, and scanned for radio frequency ID tags. Quite possibly, they were also shotgun sampled for matches against the National DNA Prime Suspects database. But there were blind spots on the Panopticon's retina. The post office, for example, still offered prompt, reliable delivery of data, and it was possible to defeat the NSA and DHS data mining if you understood how to use it. It wasn't rocket science. All you had to do was leave your phone at home, dress in clothing from which all the RFID washing machine instruction tags had been stripped, and go for a walk. You had to make sure you passed two or more postal boxes while carrying a suitably sanitized letter, addressed to your recipient by name, but showing the address of a neighbor the recipient was on speaking terms with. The Panopticon couldn't distinguish between mail pickup boxes, and a misplaced digit would disguise the destination. Network analysis, looking for friends of friends relationships, would eventually crack a postal ring, but first they had to know there was something to look for. And to muddy the waters, there was always geocaching. The old tradecraft practices of dead letter drops, cutouts, and codes turned into a hobby for the masses. Until the authorities got around to putting RFID chips in every stamp or banning cash transactions completely, the loopholes would remain open. Cypherpunks and paranoid libertarians might loudly swear that they would never, never surrender their encryption keys to the man. But in Kurt's view, there was a lot to be said for quietly archaic tradecraft. It was mid-afternoon, and Franz was at work. It was Emily's day off, but she was on a grocery run. She used shopping as an excuse to get out of the house. And River was in college. Kurt ambled to his front door, locked it behind him, and stepped out into the street. There was no sidewalk, but it wasn't dangerous. Most everyone who lived here had upgraded their wheels to self-driving in recent years to avoid the insurance premium hike for manual. Shuffling slowly, he passed the dividing line between his lot and his son's. It was almost invisible. They'd pulled out the white picket fence when they bought both houses, but the grass on his side was slightly greener, even though he never watered it. It was astroturf, as artificial as this strange lifestyle he'd fallen into in his twilight years. He shook his head, then approached the driveway. The flag on the mailbox was up. He stopped to rummage, retrieved the contents, briefly finger-checked for magnetic travel bugs on the mailbox's underside. There were none, as was usually the case since Rita had left, then walked up to the kid's front door and let himself in. He sorted the mail quickly and stacked it on the breakfast bar. There wasn't a lot. Random junk flyers from local businesses, a package from Amazon for River. Bills and banking were mostly taken care of online these days, except by old-timers. But in among the gravel there was gold dust, in the shape of a letter with a handwritten address and an honest old-fashioned self-adhesive stamp. And it was addressed to Kay Douglas. Kurt smiled, tucked it inside his shirt, and headed back to his house. It was Kurt's habit to regularly take an hour-long afternoon nap in his bedroom. Lights out, phone left downstairs. He climbed the steps patiently, with scissors, pencils, envelope, and a pad of paper in hand. An hour and a half later, he came back down, a pensive frown on his face, carrying the envelope, its enclosed letter, and the page he had laboriously transcribed from its contents. A lidded saucepan, a few drops of cooking oil, and a match would erase their troubling contents. After a trip through the dishwasher this evening, there would be nothing left save memories to trouble his sleep and that of his circumspect correspondent.
"I am going to have to tell her the truth," he told himself unhappily, as if trying on a prisoner's orange uniform for size. "Sooner or later, I will be compelled to tell her, eh?"
He gave a sad dog sigh.
"Later rather than sooner."
He opened the fridge door and pulled out a beer. Drinking alone in the mid-afternoon, he made the picture of a sad old widower. Too bad, he thought, that Greta couldn't live to see this day. The pang of loss was a pro forma emotion, barely registering any more than a phantom pain from the stump of a long amputated limb.
She'd have laughed herself sick.
His long-dead wife had been glorious in irony back in the day. She could see the funny side of everything.
What a strange age we live in. History repeats itself, first as tragedy, then as farce.